wait.
To the sort of analysis that we do here in this very lab. So motion analysis at Stanford is actually quite old. In fact, I think the first video at Stanford was one of the horse in motion to settle a bet that Leland Stanford had that while pacing, a horse has all four of its hooves off the ground, and he won that bet with these pictures that you see there and there. Moybridge was the one taking the pictures. He had a string that you tripped to take those pictures. So some main takeaway points for today. We would like you to know the two basic phases of the gait cycle. Get an idea of the kinematic, kinetic, and EMG measures of gait that we take here in lab and in gait labs around the country. And get an overview of analysis of gait disorders in cerebral palsy. So this is the gait cycle. The two main phases are stance and swing. So I think you can see here on this figure which is which, and you can probably imagine. So one gait cycle is just looking at one leg, and it's stance when it's on the ground and swing when it's in the air. Subparts of each of those are when you first hit the ground, that's initial contact, and of course there's also single limb support, which is when one foot is on the ground and the other is in swing. So it's not being supported by another leg during that part of stance. So cerebral palsy results from a non-progressive brain injury around the time of birth, so the immature brain. The brain injury is not progressive, but some of the symptoms can be. The four main deficits in cerebral palsy are muscle weakness, short muscle tendon length, also known as contracture, muscle spasticity, which is a velocity-dependent catch. So if you move your elbow like this, someone with spasticity might get here and stop if they were going more quickly. And loss of selective motor control. So muscles that always fire together or activate together when in typical walking they wouldn't, or typical other functional movements. Here's an example of diplegic spastic cerebral palsy. Does anybody know what diplegic means? Can anyone guess? Right. So I guess this is a little bit tricky, but it's one leg is more involved than the other in diplegic.
Legs are more involved than...
Oops. Yes. Yes. Sorry, yes. In this particular patient, one leg is more involved than the other.
Yeah.
So let's watch this a couple times and see if you can notice anything about his gait that might be atypical. All right, what did you notice? Mm-hmm. Good. Okay.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see that very clearly in this plane.
Excellent.
Very nice. And you also have... Yeah, you don't get a lot of reciprocal arm swing. You also had the knees turned in a little bit.
Normally you have a reciprocal arm swing, so your arm is forward when your opposite leg is forward. And as you just noticed, that's not
happening. Okay, here's another diplegic. Another patient with diplegic cerebral palsy. Okay, so what's something you notice that she's doing with that left leg? Sorry? Yeah, she does.
Yes.
Exactly.
Circumduction.
She's circumducting. So you might imagine that she's having difficulty clearing the ground using knee flexion, so she might go around instead so that she doesn't trip. Okay? Here we are, back at the gait cycle, which now has so much more meaning and is invigorating to you all. Okay, so initial contact, heel first in typical gait. You can see that the leg is fairly straight, meaning that the knee doesn't have a lot of flexion at initial contact, and the ankle is about at neutral. Mid-stance, foot splat on the ground, the tibia is advancing. So which part is the tibia? Up or down?
Down.
Down, yeah.
Then why not?
Good. All right.
Very good.
Terminal stance. So this is right before you're going into swing. Oh, I'm blocking it. You can see on the picture, you're not actually bending your ankle very much. Your heel is rising off the ground. And also you get that trailing lens, so your hip is behind you. So this would be neutral, and then you trail behind you.
So fixing that ankle in that position is really important for the forward progression of the gait, and that's your calf muscle that actually does that.
Mm-hmm. So here are our three rockers, because you have the nice guy there representing the muscles. You start out on that heel rocker. You can see that you're sort of rotating around the heel, and you have the ankle, your foot is going up, so it's dorsiflexing. And then in the middle, it's your actual ankle that you're rotating around, not so much the heel, and you start to switch to plantar flexing, so foot going down like that. And then finally, on the forefoot, is the angle about which you're rotating. So here we have flexed knee gait.
So if your calf muscle fails to provide that set of ankle rockers and doesn't restrain the tibia from rotating over the foot, the next slide shows what happens. So that's a really important function of the calf muscle. When the calf muscle is over too long or too weak, it doesn't restrain the tibia opening, but can end up in this very difficult way of walking.
Mm-hmm. Which takes a lot more energy than a typical walk. Swing phase, so you have your peak knee flexion, meaning you bend your knee the most early on when you just have lifted it off the ground to get foot clearance over the ground, and you also are dorsiflexing your ankle.
What you might notice in that is, where is the knee bent the most? Where does it reach its peak knee flexion? Yeah, that's right. In the beginning of swing, really the first third of the swing phase. So that means you have to rapidly flex your knee and get to your peak knee flexion, which is about 60 degrees, and where you have a smooth gait.
And right before you're about to contact again, your leg is straight. So, normal muscle activity, which we measure with EMG. There are two main points during the cycle when you have a lot of muscle activity. That's initial contact, when you're stabilizing the limb, and then mid-stance, when you have the gastroc going, as Dr. Rose mentioned. Sort of, what'd you say, restraining the tibia.
Over the foot. So you don't want that tibia to rotate over the foot. You have to fix the ankle, and that is where you get most of your sort of momentum, your forward momentum. Very important muscle there.
So you can see the blue arrows are pointing to those stabilizing the leg, which you can see in the EMG. This is a gait cycle, and then these bars indicate when each muscle is activated, so it's contracting when the bars are on. And you can see that early in loading and preparing for loading, which is swing is at the very end, you have the blue group, and then in mid-stance, you have the red group.
And you can see where stance and swing phase is on that graph.
So, initial contact, so this is all stance, and then this is swing. So, gait analysis in the lab, we look at kinematics and kinetics. Kinematics is location in space. Kinetics is forces. So location in space gives us things like the joint motion, which we get with these eight cameras you see up around you, and the position of light reflective markers. We'll do a demo for that later. Kinetics is the forces, and we get it from these force plates, which are basically very nice bathroom scales. They give you direction as well as the magnitude. So this is an example of some of the kinematics that we might produce in the lab. So if you look on the right on those graphs, the yellow shaded is typical gait for that age with plus or minus one standard deviation. And then the red is an example of one specific child and how their gait compares to the yellow. So what do you see? I realize it's written on the slide. But
sorry. The red person with cerebral palsy?
I don't know what the diagnosis is.
Yeah.
So,
we have a video.
So yellow is a whole group of kids without. So just a ton of kids that age came in who have typical gait, and then the yellow is the typical gait for that age. And then red is a child who came into the gait lab. I don't know whether it's specifically cerebral palsy. Probably. And then you can see, actually, some of the things so that are presenting here. If you look at the knee flexion extension, the second graph down, you can see that initial contact, the very beginning of the graph, the child is in more flexion, so their knee is more bent than in a typical gait. Whereas if you look at during swing, so that happens during initial contact and in stance, but if you look during swing, their knee is actually not getting as flexed as a typical gait. So you might say that they had stiff knee gait.
The top three graphs are what's called the sagittal plane, the side view.
So we also have increased planned reflection in terminal stance, so at the very end of stance. Stance ends right here at that final dotted line. Their foot is more plantar flexed.
Pointed down.
Mm-hmm. And they also have internally rotated foot progression, so I think toes pointing inward compared to the direction that they're going. Pigeon-toed, yes. All right, kinematics and EMG. So, let me orient you to this figure. The black bar is when this muscle would normally be on in a typical gait, and these are what we measured from the patient, and then the colors are telling you which part of the foot is on the ground. So it'll give you a good idea of where they are in the phase and also whether they make heel contact. Does this patient make heel contact? No, they're not, because there's no red. So what are some of the things that jump out at you from this EMG?
This is actually the child that you saw walking the first time.
What is on more than you would expect it to be? Can you read those? You can say third one down or fourth one down if you want.
You look at the little black lines and then compare when the black lines are from where the EMG signal is showing. You know whether it's normal.
Mm-hmm. Is the black line part explained well? Do you understand how to interpret the figure? No? Okay. So let's focus, for example, on the gastrocnemius, which is right here. This black line underneath indicates the time when it would normally be activating, and then these lines indicate when it is activating for this particular person.
Remember when the calf muscle was on in the middle of stance, the restrained, the tibia, that's what's normal.
So the gastroc is in the calf. You can see that it's on all the time, right? So it does this. So that's not very surprising given the gait that we saw, right? We can see that there's more plantar flexion than typical, and we also see that the calf is on more than typical. So that's one connection we can make between the kinematics and the EMG.
And then look at the second one down. What about that?
So,
right, mm-hmm. That's the vastus lateralis.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first child you saw, and we said the knees were bent, and now we're looking at this activity of the quadriceps, and they're prolonged. So is that a problem? Is that a
first quadriceps that would leave the leg extended further?
No.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So would you consider that a primary problem or a compensatory problem?
This is the child who is walking with flexed knees, with the knees bent.
Okay, so everybody stand up and then crouch and feel your quad. And take a step. Right? Look at all of that quadricep activity that you need to hold yourself up when your knees are bent compared to now straighten up and just take a step. And your quads are a lot more relaxed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if he didn't have his quads on while he was in stance, he would fall down because
mm-hmm.
he has his knees
open. So even though his knees are flexed, his knee extenders are on to keep him upright. Does that make sense? All right. Kinetics, so forces. This normal ankle plantar flexion moment peaks in terminal stance. What does that mean? That means when you are just about to go into swing, you have a large moment on your ankle pushing this way. Now, why would you want that? Exactly. You want to propel yourself forward. So you can see the yellow. You're propelling yourself forward at the end of stance. And so why might the red be a difficult gait?
When you're walking on your toes, you'll see what we call that double bump. Instead of pushing you forward.
Yes, good.
And just pushing
absolutely.
You up.
Yep.
Instead of getting that whole push forward.
Raise your center of mass and increase the vertical displacement and all of that causes more energy. That is a more efficient gait. This is a more efficient gait.
Which, of course, makes you tired, more tired, so it's harder to go greater distances.
Yes.
Does it also have an effect on one's balance?
Having this moment early?
It'll be a challenge to balance, but what's probably a bigger challenge is if you're on your forefoot only, you have a smaller base of support, and that will be a challenge to balance. And we're talking about spastic cerebral palsy here, but in a spastic cerebral palsy, when there's a primary problem in the cerebellum, that does present balance. Primary balance problems where you'll have a lot of sway, or if they close their eyes, they will sway more. And we do test for that here, which
yeah, that'll come up
so that we can screen patients.
Another example of something we do in this gait lab is musculoskeletal models. So this is something that Scott Delp's lab did. We can use the kinematics to model how short a muscle is throughout a gait cycle, and also how quickly it can contract.
Or lengthen.
Or lengthen, yes. So a muscle can get smaller or longer. Longer is not an active process. Muscles can only actively pull.
But here we're interested in the actual length of the hamstrings at the end of swing.
Let's see. So this is going to be a case study where we'll have hamstrings. So let's take a look. Diplegic cerebral palsy again. What does that mean?
One leg's doing more work.
Oh, no. See, I led you down the wrong road in the beginning. So diplegic means that the legs are more involved than the upper extremities and the arms. That was one specific patient was more involved in, on one side than another, but I was really leading you quite wrong with that. So let's look at this gait. Individual gait. What are you noticing? Sorry? The knees are always bent. A little bit.
There is extra motion for sure. Right. Mm-hmm. Reciprocal arms.
Let's take a look at the kinematics. So you can see that what you saw in the knee was in fact happening, more flexed during stance especially. You can see the peak flexion is about what it would typically be in swing, but it's also flexed more during the other parts of swing.
And does he get enough peak knee flexion in swing? So you'll see the red line is right smack over the yellow line, which would tell us, yes, he is flexing enough in swing, and I don't recall, I don't think the last child did, actually.
No, the last child didn't.
Did not have sufficient peak flexion, and we call that sufficient that flexion here.
So, which other graph jumps out at you? Anybody? A little bit.
Yeah.
How about the ankle? So the middle one on the bottom. You can see. I believe the last child we looked at, they were up on their toes, and they also their ankle. They were plantar flexed. Here, they're dorsiflexed. So ankle up. You can see that that's because they were in crouch and their feet were flat on the ground. So you end up having that angle that's dorsiflexed.
Everyone understand dorsiflexion is bringing your toes up towards you.
So here's an example of the modeling. We're looking at the hamstrings, length and lengthening velocities. So the area that we're particularly interested in looking at is right at the end here. So these are lengths and these are velocities. Are the hamstrings short during that ending area. So I should say the red is standard plus or minus one standard deviation, and the patient is the black line. The patient's hamstring data is the black line. Short? Short. How about slow? Are the hamstrings slow? Not as much. There's a little bit of slowness here, but here it's right in the typical range.
We will use this data actually to make a decision, along with some other information, about whether or not to lengthen the hamstring.
Mm-hmm.
To help.
That's a surgical thing.
That's
mm-hmm.
a surgical
thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that distinction between surface and dynamic EMG.
So dynamic EMG just refers to EMG taken during an activity, and you can use surface EMG and spine wire EMG. And for most muscles, we use surface EMG, and for certain deeper muscles that you really cannot record, we'll use a spine wire electrode, and that would be an example would be the posterior tibialis tendon muscle. We'll have to insert a spine wire for that. Most of the other muscles you can sort out pretty well in terms of that you're not getting cross talk from other muscles, but it's always an issue and really good question.
So can we quickly shout out the name of a muscle? Well, which of these is on more than typical? Yes, so that's the rectus femoris. It's also one of the quads. So we know from last time that they're using this extra quadricep activity to do what? Sorry.
Keep
themselves upright while their knees are bent. Okay, and then anything else you'd like to highlight from this slide?
No, just that the reason that they are bent is probably because they have short hamstrings. Relative to the bone, the growth of the muscle didn't keep up with the growth of the bone. But there's also other reasons that they could be walking in a flexion gait, and that would be a weak calf that didn't hold the tibia up. And also they could have tight hip flexors, and if your hips are flexed and you have a contractor there, you pretty much have to walk with bent knees. And so there's a number of reasons that people would walk, and this is your job is sort out
mm-hmm.
which of these are the problem.
You wouldn't want to.
Are you suggesting that you can correct these issues or problems with surgery as opposed to stretching?
Right. So, yes, the vast majority of these children do have orthopedic surgery to treat their condition. And a recent study found that what's called multi-level surgery that would address a number of different muscles, maybe at one time, about 48% improved. So it's not a perfect treatment by any stretch, but it does help children. And for this condition, specifically, I think hamstring lengthening surgery has an average result of improving knee extension about approximately 10.9 degrees of knee extension improvement. So considering they're flexed 30 degrees or more, usually it's not a complete, it's really a partial success at this point.
So are you suggesting that I could have come to you to lengthen my hamstrings by surgery rather than having my coach yell at me about stretching all the time?
No, because you would be weakened by the surgery. You would lose a manual muscle test level of strength by having the surgery, so you really only want to do it if you truly can't, if you're flexed more than like 25 degrees, no stretch.
I'm suggesting you stretch. Yeah. Is there an age range when you prefer to do the surgery?
Right. So 5 to 12 years of age, and which is a rapid growth period. And the problem here is really that the muscle growth doesn't keep up with the bone growth.
You mean within that range?
I mean, it's closer to the 5.
Mm-hmm. It depends, because you'll see kids who don't progress until later. And so you really want to watch the progression of it before you treat it. And now we're hoping that there's new technologies that could be used to treat it, such as neuromuscular electrical stimulation that might promote growth, as well as help what's called neuroprosthetic effect, actually help with the more upright gait.
Okay.
You talk about lengthening the muscle. You don't actually add length to a muscle.
The tendon gets longer.
Oh,
So the overall unit does get longer.
Have you ever taken a piece of paper and you cut in from this side and then in from this side and then in from this side and you can kind of pull it out? It's essentially the same principle.
Mm-hmm.
You're not adding more.
Yeah.
To allow it to stretch more.
Length.
Yeah.
Not to the unit, but it is a definite side effect.
I mean, the tendon doesn't usually rupture, so it's not usually an issue that you're weakening the tendon. You are moving the muscle to a different point on its force length curve, so it can't produce as much force.
Is there a belt issue with the muscle growth slowing?
So that would be a different type of cerebral palsy. So spastic cerebral palsy has those four motor deficits associated with it, the short muscle tendon length, the spasticity, the weakness, and the loss of, a very specific loss of selective motor control where synergist muscles act together to a certain degree. But that's one type of CP. It's certainly the most prevalent type of cerebral palsy, but dyskinetic and ataxic types of cerebral palsy also exist, and ataxic cerebral palsy, that would be a primary cerebellar problem that you would expect to have balance. And you never know if it may be multifaceted, and it of course depends where the initial injury is. So in the case, you do want to screen for balance problems, primary balance problems. Did I answer your question?
So we discuss this somewhat. So it indicates that the hamstrings were short. You would lengthen them. Okay, let's move on to some other possible conditions. Drop foot. So this is when the dorsiflexors pulling your toes up are not active or not working for some reason. So you can imagine that your foot is pointed down. You can trip. You have this when you put your heel down, you might just sort of drop down. You see the first Toy Story? Seems like all of the kids have drop foot because they hadn't figured out how to animate it quite right yet.
And the child that you saw that circumducted, that was really a drop foot. So her ankle dorsiflexors were weak and her foot was plantar flex because of that. And her strategy to compensate was to circumduct her leg so that she could clear her foot and not trip.
Aquinas on your toes, aquinovarus on your toes, and you also have in the frontal plane, you have your ankle coming in. Mm-hmm. Okay, some other types of bent knee gait. Go on. We're running a little bit behind, so flex knee pseudoaquinas, stiff knee. So pseudo.
So if you want, we maybe should. If you are interested in, do you want to have a volunteer do a quick kinematic test or?
You put on paper shorts, and then Chrissy will put some reflective markers.
Do we have a volunteer that? Do you want to show an example?
Oh, good. Thank you.
Come on over this way.
So we'll get you set up while we go through.
Yeah. And then we'll have to move the chairs out of the way.
Yeah, we'll need to, definitely. This is an example of a balance test. So how much, if you ask the patient to stand on the force plate and look straight ahead and don't move for 30 seconds, any person is going to sway slightly, not that much, I'm exaggerating, that would be quite a lot of sway. And a person who has a balance deficit would sway a lot more. So that's tracking where their center of pressure is over the top of the force plate. So you can see that they're swaying quite a lot more and going further from their original center of pressure. Energy expenditure, we mentioned this earlier. So the energy expenditure index is walking heart rate minus the resting heart rate, so how much it's increased with your walking divided by the speed.
A little bit like miles per gallon.
Miles per gallon.
I think of it as gallons per miles.
So is this for the patient who had the hamstring lengthening as well?
Not the same child.
No, different child. Okay, but we can see that whatever their intervention was, they have a more efficient gait post-surgery.
And this is last slide. I just wanted to mention a common gait deviation, which is when the trunk leans over to the side. And you see this in a weak hip, the abductors. You see it in a painful hip, and you'll see it in the kid, the first child that we saw walking. We saw a lot of side-to-side movement, and that was due to weak hip abductors, the gluteus and medius on the side. I call it the Baryshnikov muscle, right, because it's really well developed in ballet dancers. And the strategy is to lean over the weakened side in order to reduce the demand on the hip. And so, but also you see this in arthritis from pain, because reducing the demand on the hip will reduce the pain. And if you see it from weakness, you'll see the pelvis on the opposite side drop, as well as the trunk leaning over. If you see it purely because of pain, the pelvis stays level, it means you have that leaning over. So that's just a sort of common gait disorder, and it's called a kind of Dellenberg gait, and it's due to weakness.
Okay. Was there a question? Okay. Contralateral stop.
So
I think we can...
Yeah, I think we should maybe...
go to the demo.
Yes, go to the demo, and if you can move the chair back, because the shine on the leg will mess up the marker. Caitlin's going to tell you about that. And I realize that I'm going to... And I don't think I got a chance to introduce Christy. Light reflective markers, and the cameras are going to pick up the location of the markers. And from the location of the markers, they're going to estimate the joint eccentricity.
The cameras both send out red light, and they also can detect it coming back. It's kind of like a bat, but with light. They send out the red light. It bounces off of the reflective markers and comes back to the cameras. So that gives you which direction it is for any given camera. And since we have 8, we can put all those directions together, do a minimization, and estimate where the marker is in 3D space. And that's actually a pretty good estimation, like sub-millimeter. Okay.
This is the same technology that's used in computer games.
And depending on the game, yeah.
Yes, it is. Now, actually, they adopted it from us.
Yes.
Thank you.
I was trying to say.
And Avatar, that movie with the blue people, they put, I haven't actually seen it, but they did put a bunch of reflective markers on even a lot of tiny ones on the face and use this technology to recreate facial movements in the
material. It's weird to look at.
It's actually the same stuff on, like, stop signs and your running shoes?
Okay. It's actually corner reflectors, very small corner reflectors made of tape. So if you know from a corner reflector, any incident beam gets reflected the same way, the same angle. So that's what they used on the moon and stuff like that. So these are corner reflectors.
Hello, yours. So this is the walkway, and you can see the two force plates that are embedded in the floor. And we're going to want you to try and walk normally, but also get one foot on each force plate without crossing over the line.
Can I look at it to make sure?
Yes.
Yes, you can look at it. Normally, that would be a no-no, but since this is a demo, that's okay. All right. See his form walking across the screen? So
he's walking in several times. You're allowed to look to your left so that you can see the two or your right. So that's the floor reaction force coming up.
You can see the force here.
Force plate, and then the actual markers you can see. Especially if we turn the light down a little bit.
We have done that on, I think, didn't we do dancers class?
We have actually done dancers from the Merce Cunningham Modern Dance Troupe that was visiting, and also on a orthopedic surgery resident who wanted to do research but had no funds, and so we have him on the computer, moon dancing. But
Gangnam
style. This was pre-Gangnam style. So, yes, you can do one. Go ahead.
Sure. If that's what you want to do.
Thank you very much. Do I have permission to use that later for educational purposes? Okay, so let's take a look at the next step in this process. So post-process, once you've collected the data, you load a track in here and identify each of these markers. So, quick AC, left shoulder, scapula, right shoulder, left superior iliac spine. There will be a quiz later.
So actually, everybody feel the top of your ilium, your iliac crest here, and in front, and your forward, and you feel a prominence there. That is your anterior iliac spine, and that is a very common bony landmark that's used to place these types of markers.
Can someone guess why we would prefer to put the markers on bony landmarks as opposed to other tissues of the body?
They're all standardized.
Standardizing is one good reason. What's another one?
Flesh.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can imagine that if I put it right on this bony prominence, that's going to move a lot less.
No!
I ruined your thing. Okay.
Still working.
Good. I'm so glad I caught that. Anyway, you can imagine if I put it on a bony landmark, as opposed to on my thigh, it's going to move a lot less when I'm walking.
One of the things that Caitlin worked on, actually, is inertial-based sensing of gait events to use as a trigger for, say, neuromuscular electrical stimulation, so where you are in the gait cycle and time the muscles that you want to stimulate accordingly. And it really matters where you place those sensors. If they are noisy and moving around a lot, you're not going to be able to get a reliable record of gait events. Whereas if we say put it on the heel or on the bony part of the tibia, transition, you get much better signal.
Now you can see I've named all of the markers. They're all selected now. You can see this is a good plane to see their upward and downward motion. Down here you can see X, Y, Z motion. I can also just click one particularly interesting marker, like the knee. So once we've processed this, I'll export it and put it into a new program where I identify the beginning and end of each gait cycle. So I'll identify heel strike, which is not always heel strike, but foot strike, and then foot off, so that we can find the different gait cycles. And let's see. Oh yeah, make sure that they have left and right identified correctly, and then that goes into the program, and out come the beautiful kinematics. Unless they're not beautiful, then I have to go back in and figure out what went wrong.
Any questions?
This is actually me, because it takes actually a little bit more time than I'm pretending to get from that step to this step. And you would think it's pigeon-toed, but if you look at the marker placement, can you come out here? Can I have one of your feet, please? If you look at the marker placement, you can see that his ankle is on the outside, but for the foot, it's kind of in the middle. So it'll look like it has an angle inward, when in fact it isn't angling inward. Thanks.
Four reaction course, but the moments are calculated from a combination of that and the kinematics. And if that moment that you saw, four reaction course aspect of it, it's too high. Oh, I think he was recording, and that takes a little bit.
All right.
So, Tom Andriotti is a professor that works in this field and has done a lot of work in total joint replacement, prosthetics, and that position of that moment, medial to the knee, just inside the knee, is very important in determining whether a treatment is best using total replacement or whether you can make use of the surgery that would realign, say, the tibia. And so that's one important application of kinetics and this information that you get from the red arrow.
Learning that the bone responds to force. So if force is in the wrong place, the bone can grow in the wrong way.
Right.
So it's really important to know the stuff so that you get everything right.
At an early age, so kids are walking in a flex knee gait at a very young age, and they never extend and get their hips fully extended. A normal process doesn't happen, and that is that the angle of the femoral neck in relation to the femur doesn't move back about 15 degrees. It starts out rotated about 30 degrees, and normally from toddler walking, it gets pushed back.
Like any baby you pick up is going to have femoral antiversion, but as they walk, the forces on them help those turn out. Whereas if they don't walk because they have cerebral palsy, so they're not walking yet, those bones can grow and become stronger without those forces on them to have them turning out. So you can end up quite a lot older with the femoral antiversion.
And if you're walking but not fully extending, you also will have less of that pressure to push the neck backwards and won't be walking. So that's one example of bone response to just position.
So that is why every age you can use orthotics or use orthotics that is a corrective position.
Right, but we don't really have anything for that, for the flex knee gait. We don't have an orthotic that helps kids stay up, right? Unfortunately, which that we did, have to be really lightweight. and we're hoping that electrical stimulation at the right time and the right muscle may help. But in the ankle, yes, that is exactly right. So even the club foot, that's to address sometimes for just the crazy.
I assume this is for young children, but is there gait analysis for older people, adults, seniors?
We see about 25% of our patients are seniors. So yes, we definitely.
So how do you get in?
Get a referral from your physician and you talk to Chrissy. Chrissy is our clinic coordinator. Did everyone get to meet Chrissy?
Chrissy.
Flash pictures are great because of the reflectiveness.
You take a flash picture of it with the markers on. He likes that like a Christmas tree.
Several years of evidence.
There's some interesting research in the Human Performance Lab that looks at the possibility of people relearning how to walk to improve their biomechanics. And as it turns out, people can relearn how to walk in a way that is more biomechanically favorable and can actually improve some of these gait disorders or problems that evolve over time.
In regards to what you just said, I've been kind of running like a barefoot style in the kind of ball bent heel session, but only when I run as opposed to walking. What did that change?
That's really, really a lot more complicated question than it sounds at first. I think you should go to Scott Delp's lab meeting and then ask that question, and then you can listen to everyone talk about all the different ways in which it affects the forces on your joints. There are some ways in which a force that might be correlated with injuries is reduced, and other ways in which a different one that's also correlated with injuries is increased. So it's not really an answer of it's better or it's worse, it's just different.
You know, I think all this stuff really points out the importance of mobility. You know, if you don't have good mobility, you lose a lot of your independence.
Yeah.
And so that could be, you know, and if it's difficult to walk or it takes a lot of energy to walk, you can be more dependent on other people and less able to do things on your own. And this is obvious for both kids and adults. So I'm happy to see that there's something that can be done with older folks too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And of course, exercise is really important. We forget about the muscles that we have. and that can really make a big difference.
So they go wrong.
Right.
You were talking 25 minutes ago about the surgeries that you can do, but in conjunction with that, you said, well, maybe it's a tight calf, maybe it's a tight hip, and possibly it's a shortened hamstring. How do you decide which of those things to target? I mean, if there's so many possible sources.
Very good question, and the sorting out process, you look at the physical exam and see whether there are fixed contractures of the joint. That's your first step. So is there actually a fixed contracture of hip flexion or not? And if there's not, you can assume, for example, that then the hip flexion is not the primary cause of the crouched gait. And if it is, then you can't rule that out. Then you move down to the knee. And same thing, is the muscle tendon unit of the hamstring short or not even during gait, but just on the table, and that's called a straight leg raise. So you're lying on your back and you try to raise up your leg. It changes the position at initial contact, right? So are they restricted in that way, and are they restricted enough so that you would expect it to limit gait? So that would be maybe your next step. And of course, now having the hamstring model is really helpful during gait. And then weakness, so calf weakness could cause a crouch gait. And that test, we have a very, a physical therapist here, very difficult test for plantar flexion. She demands that you hand reflects up on your toes 20 times, so just try that right now. That's a lot of fine reflections.
So let's see if you think one foot up.
So that's really hard, and that's what normal strength, I can do 21, but yeah. So if you have weakness in the muscle, then it definitely can be contributing to crash day. And so that's part of the problem why only maybe 48% of patients were getting better in these multi-level surgeries. Another study, a third were not being helped because that sorting out process didn't happen in enough detail, and so we need more information than we have to do that. We have other problems other than flexing gait. We have stiffening gait where you don't bend your knee enough and swing, and there are things that we need to know about that so that the appropriate treatment can be delivered.
Have you done anything with people who have had a stroke?
Yes, we do see patients that have had strokes. And I think probably the electrical stimulation has a lot of promise in that population. And there is a commercially available device called the WalkAid that is specific to the tibialis anterior and prevents quick drop, which is a big problem with strokes. So there's now a single channel device that will hold the foot up through electrical stimulation and very well received. We're trying to do that with multi-channel systems now that could maybe help.
Go ahead. That's fine.
It's very nice to have you.